accession number 17429, Reel 1.
Mr. Burrows, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Born in Norfolk, Middlesex.
Which year was this?
Norfolk, Middlesex.
Which year was it?
Oh, 1929.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Norfolk?
No, Harrow, actually, which is fairly close to Norfolk.
So did you spend the whole of the Second World War in North London?
Yes.
Do you remember anything about the German bombing?
Yes, I do. Harrow was fairly close to London, as you know, but all we got was mainly incendiary bombs, and our house actually got hit by one of these bombs, but no damage done.
Were you in the house at the time?
No, I was in the air raid shelter, probably 200 yards away.
Was that a public air raid shelter?
A public air raid shelter.
What was the site of the house when you got to it afterwards?
No real problem. The bomb had basically bounced off the gutter and burnt itself out in the garden.
How frightening was the German bombing as far as you were concerned?
I don't think I had any worries as such. It was just regarded as a great adventure to an 11-year-old boy.
And what was your address at the time?
Lowlands Road, Harrow on the Hill.
Do you remember any specific buildings or streets that were hit
here,
in your area?
There was a firebomb, a petrol bomb, which exploded probably again 200 yards away on a garage and practically burnt out the garage. This was in Lowlands Road, where I lived. And then opposite was the railway station, and a smallish bomb dropped close by there. So really, we had a few bombs, but nothing like the London Blitz.
Did you go into London and see the damage there?
No, not that time, but I was involved in the V1, V2 bombing, which came later. And I was actually in Kilburn when a V2, which was the rocket, crashed down fairly close and knocked me flat.
What were you doing in Kilburn at the time?
I was working. I was about 16.
Whereabouts?
Belsize Road, Kilburn High Street.
So where did the V2 hit?
Fairly close in Kilburn. I don't really know the street.
Did you have any warning?
No.
Did you see the damage that it did?
No, not that one.
Was there any injury to you?
None to me. I was just basically knocked flat. But it being in a built-up area, the blast obviously bounced off. The other thing of interest was the actual buzz bombs, the doodle bugs, as they were called. We had a few of those over Harrow, and I was actually in the ARP then as a messenger, and I did go on to two sites and help dig out to find casualties.
You were an ARP volunteer?
Yeah. This came about because I was in the Army Cadet Force, and they asked various cadets if they would volunteer for ARP messengers. You had to be over 16.
Was this a cycle messenger?
No, foot.
What form did the digging out take? Just by hand?
By hand, basically.
Did you find any casualties?
I did, yeah. I think the thing that sickened me most was finding a dog's head.
But you dug people out, did you?
Helped, yeah.
Were they dead or alive?
Dead. I recall two dead people. There were obviously other injuries, but most people regarded me as a boy in the way.
Was this at Harrow itself?
It was, yes. It was Harrow behind the old cinema, which was the Granada at that time, and near South Harrow.
Did it spoil your inclination to continue the work after you'd come across those horrors?
I wouldn't think so. Long time ago, I regarded it as an adventure. I was a very keen army cadet. I put up my age to join the army cadets. I was 12 and a half and I said I was 14. And I, after 2 years or so, I got promoted Lance Corporal, Corporal Sergeant, and then volunteered for the Regular Army.
Any other Second World War memories?
Well, I saw the odd Heinkel flying over. I also witnessed a mass squadrons of German planes flying towards London, several hundred.
Was the war, as for you as a schoolboy, a happy time or a miserable time?
I didn't enjoy school at that time. I was 14 and left school fairly early due to the war. The school was sandbagged up. Most of the younger teaching staff were at war. We had just a few old people, and my education lacked completely at that time. Same as it did with most boys of my age. All they wanted to be was Spitfire pilots and that sort of thing.
So you felt the war damaged your schooling?
Yeah.
What was the name of the school?
Greenhill. Doesn't exist now. I went on to further my education, partly in the army and then later, and gained some academical qualifications. I've got a higher national certificate in mechanical engineering. I've got management diplomas and business studies.
Now, can you tell me about going into the army, please, and in what capacity you went in?
Well, having been in the army cadets, I'd gained my war certificate A, and I was also a sergeant in the cadets, and this got me to what was known as the 28th Infantry Leader Training Battalion in Northern Ireland. Now, we were potential NCOs or officers, and our training was for 6 months, not the usual 14 weeks as I believe it was then. And we turned out I was pretty good soldiers and leaders. I was made a Lance Corporal in my fifth week in the army. A recruit Lance Corporal, but I retained that rank for quite a long time before I got a second stripe. I found it a very frustrating time after training. I was keen to join my regiment, which happened to be the Royal Fusiliers at that time. But having finished training, I was put on training recruits and spent 6 months training recruits in Shorncliffe. Thereafter, I was on general duties for the best part of 18 months, which was anything really. Probably an interesting part was that we still had German prisoners of war then. This was 1947-48. We still had German prisoners of war. And these were used in gangs to clear barbed wire in places like Hythe near Folkestone. This was very much left to the German NCO, with just one army driver and me as a Lance Corporal in charge of probably 30 odd German prisoners of war. Obviously they had no intention of escaping, the war had long been over. So there was no danger in any way.
What exactly were the jobs they were doing?
Clearing barbed wire from the beaches. There was other things they'd done. They worked in the cookhouse, but I didn't have a lot of involvement in that.
How did you find them as men?
Well, there was a bunch in Northern Ireland before I came. Before I finished my training, we had to do guard duties, and we had German prisoners of war in a camp adjacent to our training camp, and we had to guard them. Now, these were the particularly nasty sons, those U-boat wallies and that kind of thing, and very arrogant. And we didn't have time for them, they didn't have time for us. But later, with the other German prisoners of war I was referring to, I found they were quite a good bunch. We didn't have any of the SS types, they were just ordinary rank and file, ordinary soldiers.
Can you give any examples of the attitude of the Nazi type?
No, not really.
Anything they may have said to you?
They probably called us bastards and things like that, but we'd equally call them bastards.
So you were in the Royal Fusiliers to start off with?
Yeah.
Was this the 1st Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers?
No, I wasn't assigned to the regiment or the battalion. I was cap badged Royal Fusiliers. I volunteered for the Royal Fusiliers. At that time, the army in general was divided into divisions, and I fell within the Home Counties division, which consisted of Royal Fusiliers, Middlesex Regiment, Royal West Kent Regiment, East Surrey's, the Buffs. I think there were 7 regiments all told. And when units were made up, they would select you from any cap badge. And therefore, I found myself eventually in the Royal West Kent Regiment, being seconded over. That was the thing then. If you fell within this Home Counties division, you could be cap badged to any one of the, I believe it's 7 regiments.
When do you think you might have been seconded to the Royal West Kent? Which year?
About 1950. I'd say 1949.
So when you're about 20?
20. During that time, I was posted to, well, that's referring back to 1949, I was posted to Durham Barnard Castle as a member of the Defence Platoon. You may be familiar that the Defence Platoon, the purpose is to guard the brigade headquarters, and I was a member of that platoon, still wearing my Royal Fusilier cap badge. Although the brigade up there was one of the northern districts, and that was for about 6 months, and I came back to Shorncliffe, and eventually was seconded to the 1st Battalion Royal West Kent Regiment to train up to go to Malaya.
Can you tell me about what did the training, special training for going to Malaya?
Well, we didn't have any jungle in England, but we did practice formations and tactics, and operated in some wooded area. But as I recall, it was winter time, and there wasn't any green woods or forests which would simulate a jungle warfare, and there wasn't anybody experienced enough to really teach. Now, this was the end of 1950. The Korean War had broken out. There weren't many troops available, and we were quite a mixed bunch, really. I and possibly 30 other people, NCOs and officers, were sent out to Malaya in January 1951 on the advance party. We went to the Far Eastern Training Centre to undergo jungle warfare training. This was about 5 or 6 weeks.
Where was this?
In Johor, Peru.
What did you think of the course there?
Oh, excellent. The instructor was a senior Gurkha officer, a major. We had Australian officers and NCOs, a World War II vintage who had served in Burma, New Guinea and such places. The enemy, so-called mock-up enemy, were Gurkhas. So we operated with Gurkhas, and the Gurkhas would teach us the tricks. They would ambush us, pretense, and we learnt quite a lot. At the same time, we were introduced to the Iban trackers from Borneo.
What was your opinion of them?
Well, some of them were good, and I wasn't very impressed with some of the others as time went on, and I was in the battalion, because some of these were probably Dayaks, and it's my understanding that Dayaks are more of the fisher folk, whereas the Iban is the jungle folk, the old headhunters of yesteryear and World War II. They were very good at tracking, but after a while we became fairly experienced ourselves and could prove ourselves on tracking, some of us.
What were the main tricks or lessons that they tried to impress on you at the jungle training school?
Well, the training was immediate actions if encountering terrorists whilst on patrol and attacking camps. I must say, in those days, the terrorists, we called them bandits. It wasn't until 1952 they officially became communist terrorists, or CTs, but everybody referred to them as bandits. They were well organised, well trained, probably about 10,000 regular terrorists in the jungle, in regiments and platoons, companies. Not quite the same strength as us. In platoons, probably 20 men would be a platoon, and they were designated companies numerically. They were backed up by the Minyun. Now, the Minyun was, I think the interpretation is, people's movement. These were the people which would gather the information, supply the jungle bases, and sometimes they put a part of a uniform on, even if it's just a cap, and go and murder somebody or cut up a rubber estate, slashing trees, and that kind of thing.
So after your course at Johor Bahru,
yeah,
then what happened to you?
Well, I must say that Johor Bahru was an operational area. There were terrorists in the area, and although we were on training, apart from a few mock-ups where the Gurkhas would act as the enemy, we did actually carry out active service operations with loaded weapons. Eventually the battalion came out, probably some 6 weeks later, and we were split up to train the battalion. We were allocated sections, platoons, all ranks were in the sections. It was common to have, say, a sergeant major and a lieutenant in a section which you, as a corporal, were training in jungle warfare. This was quite successful. And I believe we spent about a month training the battalion, then went up to Kuala Kubu Baru in Selangor. On the first of April, we took over operations from the Scots Guards.
Did you have any contact with the outgoing Scots Guards?
Not really. We weren't handed over. I personally wasn't handed over an area. I would think some of the senior officers some of the officers obviously interfaced with them and discussed the operational area, but I personally did not.
What was the character of the area, the terrain and so on?
It was very mountainous through the spine of Malaya, our area, which bordered into Perak. And in Perak, there's some of the highest features in Malaya. One particular area in the Cameron Islands, which is 6,666 feet. I've actually been up there, but that was some 25 years later. The operational area we were allocated was initially at Kuala Kubu Baru and stretched up to Trolak, pronounced Trola. Now this was some 40 miles away. And then later, when we got more strength, the operational area stretched towards Kuala Lumpur. So we probably had an 80 mile stretch from operating from the main road to, say, a depth of 20 miles along the main road. We were very overstretched and always under strength. Apart from sicknesses, we just didn't have enough troops. My own platoon only consisted of two sections instead of the normal three sections. We were just two section commanders. We had a platoon sergeant, but after a while he was posted and promoted into another company. But basically we operated as with a lieutenant and two corporals. This was a platoon, which was, you know, well under strength by the norm of the British Army platoon establishment.
Did you go out on patrols more or less straight away?
Yes. After taking over operations from the Scots Guards on the 1st of April, we got red hot information that there were terrorists coming to collect food at a certain area. Sungai Kailong. This was a rubber estate several miles from Kuala Kubu Baru. We went out in platoon strength. At this particular time, we had plenty of troops, but few companies. So therefore, we could make up a reasonable platoon strength. So we operated in three sections on this particular operation. When we arrived at the rubber estate, having been transported in open vehicles, which was the norm in Malaya at that time, there were very few armoured vehicles, although we did have a scout car. The scout car had twin Bren guns on top and would travel at the rear. So we got there with some measure of security, and we split into three sections on this rubber estate. One section dropped off to the right, another to the left, and my particular section moved on. So we formed a rough triangle with possibly 500 yards apart. Our allocated position was overlooking a river. At this time of the year, the monsoons had not hit Malaya, and the river was slow moving, fairly shallow and not very wide, possibly 50 yards wide. So we took up positions. I was number two in command of this section at that time. We had an officer with us and myself. I was allocated the position on the right with the Bren gunner to cover a river crossing. Now this is a track leading from the rubber estate, crossing the river, coming up the other side to a Chinese kongsi. A Chinese kongsi is a very large house, usually two to three story, where the labourers and tappers tend to live as a community. Our brief was to watch this area, and it was thought that the terrorists would be coming along to cross the river to go to this Kongsi to collect food or whatever they were to collect. We were in position probably about 11 o'clock. The tapping had finished. This was always a worry that the rubber tappers would see the security forces, and there was ways and means whereby they could send signals, probably tapping the tree with their cutting tool several times, and this sort of sound would be passed on. I was later to witness this sort of thing on other operations. However, we laid up there, and it was quite a good position because there was a irrigation ditch, and we had quite a good field of fire, and I was basically looking over the river towards this Kongsi, which would have been 200, 300 yards away, and watching the track leading down to cross the river. The rest of the section was spread out possibly 5 yards apart, watching the front. We had probably one man looking to the rear to give us some form of all-round defence. This in itself was not a particularly good idea. We should have had more people facing the rear for what happened later. However, the time moved on, and it was very, very hot. Olive green uniforms were stuck to us, of salt patches, plagued by mosquitoes, and it was very, very hot, and people began to fall asleep. I was very much awake, I believe. About, shall we say, 1 o'clock in the afternoon, three Malay young ladies came down to the river to bathe. Now, this woke everybody up. They were all very interested to see what was happening. The Malays are very modest people, and they carried out their washing, bathing, with their sarong up close around them. They were only about 50 yards away. They then departed, and we were not seen, and that was the only kind of interest that happened at that time. Later, probably an hour later, maybe less, I was looking across the river, as I say, near this Kongsi, which was probably 300 yards, 400 yards away, and I saw men moving along the trees. They appeared to be carrying weapons. This was extreme viewing. There was a sun haze and this sort of thing, and it's very difficult to see if they were communist terrorists, but we assume they were. Not all of us saw these people, because some of the section was spread out more so, and my arc of fire vision, I could see this because they were partially obscured by the building itself. However, we didn't see them come out of the building, and we didn't know if they're in there or not. There was no way we could go over and investigate. It would have broke the ambush position, and we would have been in danger of our other two sections. So the day wore on, and it was probably about, well, it was 6:30, 18:30. We were due to break ambush position at 1900. Now, I don't know what it was, what caused me to look over my shoulder. I looked over my shoulder, and there was three terrorists 5 yards away. I looked over the shoulder, and there they were. The first one was quite a tall guy. He was carrying a Sten gun, and he was moving along quite alert as the leading scout, I would say, of their patrol. The second one spaced out